long day that's waiting for us. And without further ado, I would like to introduce Professor Laurette Dubé, who is the James McGill Chair of Consumer Psychology and Marketing. She's also the founding chair and scientific director for the McGill World Platform for Health and Economic Convergence at McGill University. She's also the person and the visionary behind this program. So I would like to then proceed to the next talk, or the first talk of the day, by Professor Dubé. Oh, we have 15 minutes for each presentation, by the way, and we'll adhere to that. And there will be 10 minutes for questions.
Can you put my presentation, please?
Sure.
Very bad.
I should also mention that these presentations are being recorded. So for that reason, we'd like to kindly request the presenters to stay at the podium, and that will be most optimal.
This is forward. Yeah, can I use the arrow? Yeah.
It's not working as well. Oh, here.
Yeah.
You can use that one.
Okay, that's good. Good morning, everybody. It is a pleasure to be, for the first time, in fact, having a full brain to society as part of the mainstream obesity conference. We have evolved for the last 10 years, I would say, on the fringe, by two ways. As a brain, what we call the brain to society team of obesity, we started being funded as a team in 2005 by FRSQ, receiving subsequently grants from CIHR and NIH, and very recently we just got an additional team grant from Medical Research Council of India and CIHR for this Brain to Society approach to childhood obesity. Many of you may have heard about the weird McGill Health Challenge think tanks that we have been also having since 2005, where progressively we have started building the ocean liner that Vuhal is talking about. So what I'd like to do briefly is give you an overview of the brain to society paradigm, and then give you a brief overview of two descriptive studies that have been recently published in AGCN that will give you a sense of the why we need to study to complement the existing approach by this brain to society. So I think Vuhal had made very eloquently the case that we have many, whether it's obesity, chronic diseases, we have many problems of the modern world that are tied to the fact that progressively modern society has become misaligned with the limit of biology, whether it's human biology or natural biology with environment. And essentially what we are talking about is to say so much has been coming out over the last 300 years of industrialization and scientific development, including the knowledge and on the medical domain, including all what has been invested and discovered on the gene and brain. The question is that in parallel to this, there has been evolution on the scientific level in the social science, in business, economics, political science. This is science too, and that is the point of this, the reason for creating this brain to society paradigm as being rooted in all of the above, but the need to bridge those together is that it is those divide that essentially are at the root of what we are having so much problem to tame, the famous wicked problem of obesity and chronic disease. So essentially this 21st century paradigm that we are talking about is from having siloed approach to being much more interdisciplinary, looking at convergence in terms of to what extent each pieces of the puzzle that each silo brings to what extent does it contribute to a more complex and dynamic understanding of the context that we need to change. Barrier between domains, building collaborative network. Few underground change in the sense that science typically has been what is happening in the lab and then it is transferred to the innovation pipelines to society. And I think that it is one of the key features that we need to change. Science is not independent of society. Scattered expertise, I think that when Vural was making the point to say it is absolutely okay to be expert and to have the cutting-edge knowledge that you have in your discipline. And the idea is really find a way to get the best mind of the best in all of the discipline and give them some vision of what they can contribute together. It is not multidisciplinarity. When I started working on this and progressively building this network, it was in the context of having received a career award from CIHR, medical NSERC, and SSHRC when the Medical Research Council became CIHR. And the idea, I was one of 11 non-health scientists that was given such award with the idea of buying us out of teaching. We teach a lot in business school. And to see to what extent we can enrich the scientific basis of population health and health service, where much of the knowledge is in those various domains of society that create the environment. And the other aspects also, in particular when we look at obesity, it goes from the cell to the global systems that we have been putting together, going through family, school, and community, and so on. So those McGill think tanks that you may have heard about, we started in 2005. We were the first meeting that we convened the best neuroscientists from around the world to see can we know more of the human machine so that we can see to what extent it can be woven into more effective, more targeted intervention, as well as into policy. And progressively, at those think tanks, we were having scientists, we were having policymakers, we were having industry and society leaders. And for 4 years, we have been focusing on childhood obesity, progressively moving to other issues related to food and nutrition. And along the idea of the need to have this, the knowledge of the brain and society to permeate what is happening here, at those think tanks we were having, like the CEO of Campbell, in the context of food and nutrition security, said at some point, it's ridiculous when we have all the logistic and the resources that we have in the food system around the world that we cannot address hunger. So started to produce something that is nutritionally balanced, starting with Canada, but progressively planning to move to the World Food Program. Danone, Louis Frenette, the CEO of Danone, saying at one having committed about 3 or 4 years ago to say, well, let's see if we can reduce 25% sugar in our yogurt. It may have a significant impact. So the notion of, and I will skip this here, the notion, so progressively, and I'll come back to the slides that put this together, progressively during that time we have been producing much based on the research but also based on the thinking of convening all the those leaders. There are two books out that gives you a good sense. One, which is a very thick handbook on obesity prevention that was released from Elsevier in 2010 that give you the full comprehensive view going from gene, brain, up to various society and system science. And in parallel, along these lines of systematically weaving the knowledge of those science into action, we had been working with WHO and public health agencies at all levels in Canada in producing this trade food diet and health book. So this ocean liner that Vural was presenting, you can see it all together in the sense that the scientific pillars, the five pillars of the Brain to Society approach is let's bring the cutting edge of all gene, brain, genomics, as well as moving to society, business, economics, political science, moving then as we will be, as you will see as the day unfold, in the health science, we move there to the most recent development in surveillance in the infectious disease that have been using intelligence artificial to say we can find ways to get quick and rigorous access to data to support decision. So the idea is to say we have equipped medical doctor with good ontology, we are equipped emergency for good detection of H1N1, can we equip society for actually turn a bit the boat so that we address the problem of obesity. Complexity, system science, and then as we move this interactive action between science and society. So those are the pillar of the... we skip this one. Those are the pillars of the Brain to Society approach. And I'm putting here some of the early, and I will talk about two of them. How much longer? Five? Okay, I will talk about two of them. Those are to give you a sense of the type of publication we have done so far. Doesn't include any of the work that each of the experts has been doing. You will hear Alain, you will hear Robert. This is here. Some of the papers that start capturing this approach of Brain to Society. First one here, it's a study we did in Montreal. Catherine Paquette, Mark Daniels, and a few others here, where we essentially, when we talk about biology in the context of the food environment, we have been starting our the development of our approach anchored into DOPA systems, the fact that our human machines has learned from millions of years of evolution to like what is sweet, what has calorie, and not to move too much. So with this context here, the notion of reward sensitivity is a concept that in this study we measure at the psychological level, but it's really to capture individual differences to impulsive reaction to motivating food cues in the environment. And what we did here, so I explained here reward sensitivity, palatable food, degree to which food you promote overconsumption. So let's skip here. So what we have been doing here for about 400 and more adults in the island of Montreal, we have been geocoding a buffer zone of 500 meters around each subject's residency. And with the idea of examining the single and moderating role of sensitivity to reward and the density of fast food in the environment to in relation to the actual food fast food consumption. So what we, 415 individuals, they were in the 7th census tract of the whole island of Montreal, covering the whole socioeconomic status, as well as French and English. And we measured the density of fast food as per the geographic information system that I was showing earlier. And then look at the relationship here. So our outcome variable was a reported fast food consumption, predicted fast food exposure as measured by the density of fast food restaurants within 500 meters, and the reward sensitivity as expressed by the psychological scale. Covariate, age, gender, income, and education. So see what you, logistic regression, I skip this here. Those are the results that I'd like to point to two of them. One is that if you look at the main effects of this psychological, the individual differences in reward sensitivity, This is a very strong, well, strong by that type of statistics. It is one of the most highly significant effects of individual differences in vulnerability to cues in the environment. The density of fast food per se at the aggregate level did not have a significant impact. And however, when you look at the interaction, is that, and that's the... That's the slides here. Well, you see that if you are individually resistant to exposure, whatever happened in the environment doesn't affect your consumption. What you do see here, this graph is the log odds ratio of that having consumed fast food. What you do see is that for those in the middle that are the top tertile on this individual scale, is that the more you have the highest density in the environment, the more your behavior is impacted. And what is important to observe also, so those results before were after having control for income, gender, education. Now, if you take this top tertile, who are they? And what you do see is that they are, in addition, doubly vulnerable in the sense that they come from lower income strata in the society, and typically fast food have been so far more dense in those neighborhoods and lower education. So that's one study. The other one, I will just briefly talk about it. It just got accepted last week in American Journal of Clinical Nutrition. And this one talk about less about individual vulnerability and more about the type of processes that we need to start looking at if we want to move beyond the present approach that is focused on nutrition, education, and so on. And this one here was 160 women still in Montreal who for 10 days, 6 summer days, were telling us, reporting what they had been eating and what were their emotions on the series of items prior and after the actual consumption. And what we were examining is the following. We're seeing, we do know in the literature that home is the place where we generally are in the best of our positive mood, positive emotion. And the theorizing we're saying is that it is also known that eating at home is also typically healthier than eating away from home. And what we were saying is that, and no one knows exactly why, because if you want to buy junk food, you can get junk food at your home as well as in restaurants. So we're saying, I have to say, much inspired after having looked at kind of the thought through from our perspective the result, we're saying, can this be that healthy food come with a biological handicap? We are not programmed to like them, so that if repeatedly once we eat them in a home environment, and this home environment is tied to more positive emotion, could it be possible that food eaten at home that are in general are followed by more positive emotion than away from home? And in addition, this added value will be more impactful for healthy food. And what we do see here, the healthy meal were followed by more intense, home meal were followed by more intense positive emotion and less worry than away from home. What is relevant is that home meal that were healthier than a person's baseline were followed by more intense positive emotion, and the relationship, in fact, was in the opposite direction away from home. So it's less the detail of the study that I wanted to present that gives you a sense of the type of things that we have neglected, if I may say, by an emphasis either on education and knowledge and so on, or completely trying to change the environment without really informing those change by this brain to society understanding that we have now, and we can put together in some scientifically manner that hopefully will have a societal impact. Thank you.
We have time for three questions. We run a little bit late, so please introduce yourself when you ask a question.
I'm Bill Comers from the University of Alberta. A lot of interesting findings. I was just wondering about this. Is an alternative interpretation that you feel guiltier by eating crappy food at home?
No, there was no difference. We also measure guilt, and there was no difference on guilt. There was no, because we look at the full diversity of negative emotion, guilt was part of it, and there was no difference. The difference was that you felt more positive and less anxious at home.
Other questions? The audience? I have a comment. Oh, sorry, go ahead.
Nazir Mohajer from Saskatchewan. Just to follow up on this particular finding, so is the pre-meal anticipation on the positive, emotions, is that related to the family, the being part of the family, being at home, and a meal being prepared that you know that actually you're going to consume, so is that which actually doesn't happen at meals, because it's prepared for you.
Yeah.
The only thing, if you go to good restaurants, you'll get served a good meal, but other than that, you don't have that base instinct of being part of family.
We did not get into that type of debt and starting to generate alternative account and pursuing further. But what we did, though, allow us to address some of the concerns that you are talking about there. What subjects were doing is that they were telling us, as a function before entering into in the protocol, we were talking with them to make sure that they have the same understanding of LT eating than the rest of us. So there was kind of a training session where there was an understanding of what is LT or less LT. Then subjects were giving us kind of what is for you your typical meal for each of breakfast, lunch, and dinner. And then as they completed those momentary report, it was essentially to tell me, is this meal equally healthy to the baseline, more or less healthy? So we built it into this kind of repeated occasions within the same subjects. So all home meals were taken at home. And what we did find is that the difference between the healthier meal compared to the baseline, they were both, and that's interesting, they were both followed by more positive emotion. And the experience of positive emotion prior to the meal was also more likely to trigger a healthier meal. So there's a lot of further, and I think Robert will follow, there's a lot of further explanation to be elaborated further. But when you look into the built-in of our multiple exposure within the same subjects, that gives some control for those issues.
All right. If there are no other questions, I will proceed to the